Go ahead.
Good morning and welcome to this meeting of the Administration and Operations Committee. Can I please get a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Allen?
Present.
Mr. DeClean?
Here.
Mr. Helling?
Here.
Mr. Christensen?
Here.
Quorum?
Thank you, Jan. And let me just welcome Jerry Allen to the A&O Committee. Brings a lot of experience and a wealth of knowledge, so we're happy to have you on board, Jerry.
Well, thank you, Bill. Hope everything is going well for you and your family.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. We're doing great. So we've got item number one is a number of internal audit reports from Clifton Larson Allen. So who here from CLA will be presenting on that?
Good morning. There are two of us from CLA. I is here and Dan Ludwig.
Great. Whoever's up first, go ahead and take it away.
All right. Very good. Thank you very much. I'll go ahead. Thank you very much for the opportunity to propose here today. In addition, CLA wants to give its heartwarming thanks for all the opportunities that we have had with Seamers. We value the relationship, and we really appreciate all the efforts that have been shown by the organization, specifically to the internal audits we have been executing over the past several months and since our last presentations. We really appreciate the opportunity. So, and I'll turn it over to you and you can walk us through our presentation, please.
Dan, you're not coming in here. Dan Ludwig, can you hear me?
Yeah, Dan, it's real choppy. Maybe you could try taking your video off or maybe closing some other apps if possible.
Or you can just call in.
No, Dan, it's not.
It's not working.
It, next to the mute button, the little carrot, if you hit the carrot, it shows you an optimization button. Check that button and see if that helps. Or get rid of your...
He left,
your,
I think he's going to rejoin or something.
How's this?
No, Dan. If you can get it, Dan, just call in as well. Use the phone number on the link.
Yes.
And just mute your computer side. Who called in from the number ending in 03? Four one four nine something something 03.
Sorry.
and if we're not able to get Dan back, would somebody else from CLA be able to go through the reports?
I was just going to ask Dan to give me a call so I can put him on speakerphone, actually. So, let's do that. Yeah, I'm going to put you on speakerphone so that you can, if you, as long as you can see the screen, then you can do the presentation using the phone. Yeah, all right, hold on. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. I think everybody can hear you now. Go ahead.
Okay. All righty. Apologies for the technical problem this morning. I'm not sure what exactly is going on there. To start with today, thank you for allowing us to join with you with the A&O committee this morning and provide to you the internal audit results for four audits today. Terry, we're pleased to present the results on the entity level controls, also known as the COSO 2013 audit, the investment audit, the benefit calculation audit, and the, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Terry, am I still on?
Yeah.
Okay. Entity investment and, for those three audits. Okay. All right. So we'll start with a quick presentation or the slide. Terry, if you mind, slide, next page. Okay, so at this time, we have presented to you the cybersecurity audit that was performed by David Anderson back in December. We're going to present to you today entity level controls, the benefit calculation, and the investment management. The accounting and finance audit is still open. It's 50% complete. The reason why it is not complete at this time is due to the fact that there were competing priorities with the with other organizational needs during the course of 2025, most notably requirements and requests made by the Legislative Audit Bureau. We are on track to complete it in the next, within Q3 of 2026, and we'll be able to present that to you during the September Audit A&O Committee meeting. Terry, if you want to switch to one of the three audits. Okay. So during the course of 2025, we performed a review of the benefit calculation process. Terry, if you want to slide down maybe about two or three pages. Keep going. The benefit calculation process is the process by which the benefit payments are calculated for each of the participants within the pension plan. And during that course of that process, there are a number of controls that are in place over the systems as well as over the actual calculation of the pension plan payment that will be made. The process has a series of controls. We basically categorize them into four groups. We look at the benefit calculations, we look at the employment contracts, again, system access and restrictions, and then overall organizational resilience. And organizational resilience really feeds to the fact that the organization is capable of performing this work on a regular basis to ensure that accuracy and completeness of the process is put in place and that the payments are calculated correctly. Terry, if you want to slide down a slide. Actually, keep going down one more. Go down to the chart. Thanks. I want to start by saying that during the course of this audit, and for the other audits for that matter, the Siemers team provided all the information necessary to complete the audit. and was transparent about all the information provided. The team continues to excel at this in being very open and forthcoming about issues that they may be experiencing and so forth. But at the time of the audit, the organization continues to perform at a very high level and is comparable to years in the past. As part of our testing, we look at, and I'm going to start through some of these steps real quick. We look at the benefit calculation process. We test various types of benefit payments that are made during the, as part of the benefit payment process. So we look at disability payments. We look at the standard service retirement payments. We look at some exceptional things such as if there's an employment termination payment or a survivor benefit payment. During the course of this testing, there were no identified issues identified with any of the payments that were tested. And as a result, for each one of these areas, we also make a representative sample and test to make sure that this is in fact the case. We pull populations from the current audit period, and we basically go back to the basic, to the time that the employee becomes a part of the process to the time that he actually receives his first benefit payment. We look at the employment contracts to make sure that merit system has been up to date, make sure that the appropriate approvals and processes are in place to make sure that those calculations that are being performed for the benefit calculation process are actually being drawn upon from a system, and that those changes made in the system have been approved and have been then also validated or audited by an independent party within CMERS. System access segregation of duties and access to PII. These are basically the internal controls that are set up over IT to ensure that that there is the necessary controls to ensure that unauthorized access is not allowed, making sure that personal identifiable information is contained to only those people who truly need to have access to it, as well as making sure that there's a proper segregation of duties within the organization, meaning that someone does not have the opportunity to engage in or use system functionality that would otherwise potentially perpetrate fraud or lead to some sort of financial miscalculation for the benefit payment for the individual. The last item is organization resilience. We look at a number of areas here, but we specifically focus on things where it pertains to cross-training and making sure that the policies and procedures needed to actually determine that the benefit payment calculation process is being actually performed correctly. Standard procedural instructions are the are essentially how to do what they do. And we inquire with management, we have to make observations, et cetera. We talk about, again, kind of like what happens in the event that there's changeover and so forth, and we gain confidence or comfort that the process is in place. I am proud to announce, like in last year, prior years, the organization continues to perform at a high level, and that the personnel continue, they continue to perform at a high level, and they are again being checked and monitored across the organization. There were no errors that were identified or could be reported at this time. The organization, as you can see from this chart, if you go back up to the top, Terry, you can see that we rank the internal control environment according to kind of a matrix or a rating system. We've identified many of the organization control processes defined. This is the sweet spot in where we would expect most organizations, including CMERS, to be operating. There are certain areas within CMERS that are managed, which is a higher level of internal control reliance, and that is where you are actually able to utilize or pull from automation to that ensures that the processes that are in place are actually more automated and more optimized for the organization. So again, just in terms of the benefit calculation process, the team has done an exceptional job. The organization continues to operate at a high level, and there were no internal control findings. I'll hold for a minute. and if there's any questions, I can address.
Great. Thank you, Dan. Are there any questions from committee members or staff?
I have a question, Bill.
Yes, Tim, go ahead.
Just with like the exponential growth of AI, just wondering how you kind of calculate that or see that in the future, if we're going to be able to automate away even more stuff, or is that why we bumped up to managed? We're using it more often, or?
What we could, we will continue with, in terms of the use of AI, we will look for opportunities to use or use AI to improve the audit. However, we will not necessarily do so without obviously getting the acceptance or approval from the CMERS management team. In terms of where the process is right now, until maybe CMERS introduces an AI component into its processes, we don't see anything at this time where we can leverage that at this time, only because much of what the benefit calculation audit is required to do is to examine actual hard copies at this time for various attributes such as signatures and calculation processes and so forth. While we can utilize system reports that provide us with some guarantee that the system functionality has not changed, we still go through the process to make sure that the calculations are actually accurate, and we double check that as part of the process. In the future, we will look again and examine opportunities where we could leverage that, but again, we're not going to necessarily rely on that until we get, you know, unless we're able to determine that with the use of or through the partnership with management.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
I have a question for Terry or Patrick, maybe, kind of if we are using any AI, is kind of what my question was, to automate more processes.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Patrick, go ahead.
Oh, thanks, Bill. Yeah, it's a really interesting question, Tim, and a timely one. I just happened to be at the NCPERS conference, the Chief Executive Summit, where we have quite a few peer plans in here, and AI has been a pretty large topic at the conference, discussing how plans are approaching it, what the implementation policies have been for those plans that have adopted it, and the overwhelming consensus is that the AI cannot touch member data yet. There's a very, very, I think it's fair to call it an extreme reluctance to introduce sensitive data to an AI system, even internal AI systems. And those plans that have adopted it essentially in a help desk sort of way, using only publicly available information, plan documents, handbooks, things like that. So. I think it's safe to say that some plans are dipping their toe in the water, but at this point, there does not seem to be a widely accepted use case to assist with things like benefit calculations or actual plan administration at this point. So we are not alone in not having adopted any AI process. In fact, I think we're still with the majority of plans who are looking for that safe use case that will actually add value to the organization, and I think we're just not there yet.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Tim. Any other questions from committee members?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Jerry.
Yes,
I just wanted to follow up with Patrick. Patrick, could you expound a little bit on why there's the reluctance to expose member data to AI?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Jerry. And I mean, we could, Terry and Jeff could probably explain this in a much more sophisticated way than I will. But a lot of the, it's improving, but a lot of the AI capabilities that are out there essentially share data, uses data to learn, uses the data that it takes from your organization to help improve its functioning in other organizations. And there's just not an overwhelming guarantee of security. And because of that, plans to this point have only been willing to share that, like I said, that public information, which is already in the public domain. But once you get into things like, you know, benefit numbers, bank accounts, you know, even medical information, obviously, for certain benefits that we offer here, there's just not an effective way at this point to control what happens with that data or even where it's housed. In a lot of circumstances, AI is run on servers in foreign countries or in other states. And I think just generally there's a real concern over the safeguarding of that information. So if, you know, Terry or Jeff, if you have anything to add to that, in addition to what I've seen here, I'd certainly welcome it.
Well, this is Jeff, the Chief Technology Officer. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to the board. Patrick, you're spot on, and to make it succinctly, any data that you put into an AI engine becomes public data. So that's the problem. All these large language models that are out there, they learn from public data. So any documents you give it, any social, even in the query, if I have queried on a social security number, that's not public. So that's the danger of this, is any data you actually input into it in any fashion or allow it to look at your any of your files or your website, if you give it access to it, it becomes public data. So we are very reluctant to let anything like that out, even as simple as a staff member doing a query with a particular piece of information, that's not public data. So that's the danger of it, and you can't control it once it's public.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. And the only other thing I'll add, I mean, as you can see from this internal audit report, you know, we have achieved the managed level for certain of our operations. And, you know, I think one of the biggest takeaways I'm leaving this conference with is that we need to be grateful, extremely grateful for Merits. It is an outstanding application. It is really refined our processes at ERS since its implementation, and just talking to different peer plans and discussing what their benefit administration applications look like, we are in like the top 10, if not top 5%, in terms of having an application that works for us, that does a great job and produces internal audit results like this one. So even some of the mega plans are still using software that requires the black screen with the green letters. So I think the fact that this internal audit report has achieved the managed level really demonstrates the fact that Merits, you know, is a sufficient level of automation for our purposes. And I was already grateful for it, but I can tell you that I'm leaving this conference with even more appreciation for it. So I just wanted to put that out there that I think that we're doing very well compared to some of our peer plans.
Mr. Chair, this is Jerry. I just wanted to, not to belabor this point very much, but I just wanted to, as long as Patrick's had some exposure to the conference this week. Patrick, what about data that's, you know, I would say, you know, ancillary or separate from the member data? I mean, we have a number of, you know, core functions at ERS that don't involve member data, you know, for example, you know, aggregate financial reporting. Certainly our asset managers employ AI in some instances. And I just, you know, and I know David has talked about this a little bit in the past about, you know, AI applications for use in monitoring performance. We have pretty good stats available to us now through the subscriptions that we sign up for. But what about the use of AI in investments and financial reporting? And you don't have to answer that question now. It's just not a theoretical question, but a question for future consideration.
My audio cut out, Jerry, when you first started talking, so I'm not sure if that question was directed at me. But if it was, yeah, I mean, we're, you know, Jeff and I talk frequently about, you know, the potential for the implementation of AI. I think the consensus is that it will generally improve operations for, you know, across different sectors and organizations. And so I believe that at some point, there probably will be some type of AI product that we can implement here, but we're, you know, intentionally doing so in a way that secures member data and protects the organization. So the short answer is I'm sure we'll get there at some point, but there doesn't seem to be a product out there yet that fits our particular needs.
Thank you, Patrick.
I'll just add to that, Mr. Chair. One of the concerns is the segregation of information. And if you introduce an AI engine into the environment without having proper understanding of how and what it accesses, if we lock it down too much, it won't really be intelligent. And if we open it up too much, then it'll have access to information that we really don't want it to get to. And finding that happy medium as to where it's somewhat useful to us is the trick. And right now, across the industry, the problem has been that AI has been introduced and then they let it run rampant. Like, I'll give you an example, like with the thing that happened with Amazon a little while ago, where it accidentally promoted, where it created code, it tested code, it validated the code, it promoted the code, used the code, and ended up killing about a few million dollars worth of coders. So there has to be controls around it, and even the big tech companies, if Amazon is having issues like that, we have to be cognizant of those and careful with those. So we're taking it in little baby steps, trying to see how we can introduce it, but with only data we give it specifically, if that helps.
Thanks, sir. One more point.
Thank you.
Can I make one more point? This is Jeff. So there's one more facet about the AI as it's implemented today. We actually have brought a small engine in-house, but to run AI efficiently, it actually uses very specialized hardware. I think last time the cards we looked at, the low-end cards started at $25,000 per card, and you would need multiple cards to actually implement an engine internally, and we would want to do it internally so that the data didn't get out into the public. The other facet about that is those cards are they're starting to become obsolete after about 2 years. So the cost, just anecdotally, the cost of the AI explosion right now, I'm not sure it's going to be sustainable in the long term. All these data centers are getting built. The cost to the industry is huge. And I don't know that it's cost effective to internally do it. So that means you'd have to go outside into a public model. And the public models, again, have the problem where anything you put into it is public. So that's just another facet of it. Until all of these, the mathematics and the algorithms and the hardware all start to sort themselves out where it's actually cost effective, I'm not sure we're going to dip our toe too far into it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I had a question, but Patrick is not a member of the committee. Am I allowed to ask a question?
I don't see any issue with you asking a question. I believe we had Jerry ask a question a few months ago, wasn't a member of the committee. I don't believe there's any rule prohibiting it.
Sure, go ahead, John.
All right, thanks for the discussion. Specific to the AI and search, I ask and answer a lot of questions, and in the past I've always gone to the search box on Seamers.com, and this is probably a Jeff and Terry question. And the search results are often a long list of PDFs and meeting minutes, and you got to kind of wade through and see if you can find what you're looking for. And now with the advent of AI, if I put the same query into Google AI or some other software, it scrapes that public data that's available from Chapter 36 and gives you more of a conversational answer. Would it be possible to somehow in the future restrict the search just to that public data that would be already available on the Seamers website through the search box?
Yeah, I'll scoop Terry and Jeff on this one, and then I'll let them answer. John, you hit the nail on the head for those few plans that have implemented AI, at least those, and I know it's anecdotal, the ones that I've spoken to at this conference, that's exactly what they've done, is that they've, I believe Amazon Web Service is one of the services that was mentioned, where you can upload specific documents to the service, and then it only draws from those documents when providing a response. So it's sort of a limited universe large language model that, you know, and it essentially results in an AI help desk. It is kind of the application that most plans are pursuing at this point. So something like that is possible. That was something I was planning to bring back and discuss with staff. I have absolutely no idea what the cost is. So that would be a big question. And we've also seen the response to the question of, well, are people using it and finding it helpful? There wasn't an overwhelmingly yes, it's been amazing. People still want to pick up the phone and talk to somebody rather than rely on an answer that they get from an AI chatbot. So I think there is some potential for use there, but its utility and cost, I think, are really an open question. So having said that, sorry, Terry or Jeff, I think I cut someone off, but please chime in with anything else you have.
That's fine. The other thing I was going to add was there's a training time and risk associated with that. So if we put it on our website, yes, are we considering it? Yes, as Pat was mentioning. But there is going to be training time for that AI engine to make sure that it kind of gives at least reasonable answers. And that is going to be time consuming, because the last thing we need is for Mr. AI to go back into the open and give a response that'll be incorrect and somebody relies on it and creates a problem for us. But that, again, with the large language model, being able to search, we will be playing with it. We have started a little bit. We did like a quasi-internal run. Wasn't really the best, but we need to play with it some more to see what we can do with public information, very specifically with whatever we upload to it. And that, Mr. Barmore, might go back to like the information that's available on the website, or specifically uploading those, like Chapter 36 and a few documents here and there, to see how it responds. Not that Chapter 36 is confusing at all. So let's see how that works out.
Great. Well, thank you for a very enlightening discussion on AI and its potential use cases. Are there any other questions from anybody on the benefit calculation process audit? If not, we can move on to item B, the investments audit report.
Sure. Terry, do you think you could skip down to, I think it's page 4? It's kind of a quick summary of the processes that we look at and how we look at things. So as part of our audit for the investment management process, first of all, I want to start by saying, again, similar to the benefit calculation process, the investment management team led by David Silver and Eric Sauer, exceptional team, highly transparent, quick to provide information promptly, that is, and then also thorough. They're great to work with, and again, just a very competent and great team in terms of being able to respond to our needs in a timely manner. So, and that gives us all a lot of comfort, because obviously, you know, the faster you respond and so forth like that, and more complete the answer is, the more comfort you get, right, about the process. And this comfort plays out in the process because, and I'll just give a spoiler alert, there were no issues with the investment management audit. Now, some of the things that we looked at during the course of the audit were, we looked at the service provider selection and termination process. So we looked at how you select a new investment broker or consultant that would support the investment management team. We looked at the contract review process. We looked at the management and board of directors approval process. We looked at how contracts were managed. We looked at performance analysis and reconciliation. Again, we looked at more of the due diligence and review that David and his team do during the course of the year to ensure that the investment brokers are actually doing what they're supposed to be doing, and that there isn't any issue with those said brokers that would cause the investments to become at more imperiled or at risk. We look at the calculation and approval of the payment to the investment managers for their fees and the process that goes through. Again, we look at the invoice review and reconciliation process. We look at the investment policy compliance process and the policies that are in place and making sure that those are regularly reviewed and updated. We look at the management board reporting process, and the sufficiency of that as it pertains to the assets and so forth, and making sure that that is in compliance and complete. And again, we come back to the two of the items that we previously discussed, and that is system access restrictions, making sure that the appropriate people have access to the systems, most notably our Northern Trust, but also the banking relationships that you have. Make sure that, again, that there's organizational resilience so that in the event that there was an event which caused turnover within your organization, that the team members that support over there within the department are capable to step up as a board in the event that there is a need to do so. Terry, why don't you just scoop down another slide down to the chart? So similar to the previous report for benefit calculation, our processes here are in a defined state. This is the sweet spot of where you want to be with an organization that largely has a lot of manual processes involved. In this case, we're looking at the reconciliation of fees and making sure that those are properly calculated and paid out, those processes that control that functionality. We're looking at, of course, the approval process and review process performed by the A&O committee and the board, making sure that those things are in place. So, and then in addition to that, those other things that I mentioned, such as the selection of investment brokers, we're looking at how you manage the contracts, etc. And again, Terry, if you want to again slide down on the slide. And again, as you can see, we do not have any issue with any of the areas that we tested. And again, we do not have any findings or process improvement opportunities at this time that we can share with you. The team does an exceptional job. This process is well-worn and true. The team continues to perform at a great level. And again, organization resilience, in the event that there was some turnover, everyone is in a capable and competent position to do so in the event they are called upon. Again, we have no issues or findings for this. So I would welcome questions at this time.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions from committee members? Or questions from staff or other board members? Excellent. Well, let's move on then to item C, which is the governance COSO audit report.
Terry, if you can slide down again to page 4. So the objective of, I'll start with by just talking about what COSO 2013 is. So the objective of COSO 2013 controls framework assessment is to review and evaluate the entity level processes and controls that are in place against, and then we evaluate them against leading practices of a COSO internal control integrated framework. This framework is universal to organizations, and while it is, it means something different to different organizations, the guiding principles of COSO are common to all organizations in the framework. So there are 5 components to COSO, and they are quickly the control environment. This is the tone at the top. This is the organization. How do they establish oversight, and how do they hold people accountable for control responsibilities? This is board of directors review. And of course, how do they project integrity and ethical values within the organization. Next area is risk assessment. This is how the organization evaluates risk and how they evaluate the potential for fraud. How do they assess changes that could significantly impact the system of internal control? And again, is there sufficient clarity to enable the identification and assessment of risks relating that may impact the organization going forward? The next area is control activities. These are those controls that are in place. They mitigate the risk of the that would impair the ability of the organization to meet its objectives. These are your review of the financial statements. These are your how is technology proper in support? Do you have proper budgeting? Do you have proper analysis? The involvement again of the board and management, and then of course, have you properly deployed those services that help management basically ensure that this is in place? So, for example, the use of an internal audit group, for example, internal audit services. These types of roles and functions that enhance the environment and guarantee, or to some, largely guarantee that the organization is operating effectively. And then the final one is information and communication. This is again about our use of IT, the controls in place over IT, how it communicates with external parties, matters affecting the function of the internal control environment, the quality of the information being generated, who reviews, how is it being handled and managed within the organization, etc. And then finally, we have monitoring activities, and the organization selects, develops, and performs ongoing and separate evaluations to ascertain. So this, again, comes back to the internal audit functionality. I mean, how are we involved? What are you doing to ensure that the processes are in place and operating effectively? The last point here is how do you manage or communicate internal control deficiencies in a timely manner? Making sure that you're aware of these things both internally as well as being transparent with outside organizations and so on. Terry, if you want to slide down to the chart. So again, and there's a description of each of the controls that are here. I won't go through all of them, but effectively all of the organization's controls are in a position where they are, again, in that defined or that sweet spot of internal controls. There's not a lot of opportunity in any of these cases to automate and then achieve that managed level of control maturity, if you will. But again, the organization continues to perform at what we would expect it to and at a high level. Again, speaking about all members of the team that we met with, and this includes Terry Siddiqui, Dan Pollan, and other members of management, the team was very transparent, prompt with the information. Cases would gather a lot of information through the website, noted that was being done in a timely manner, which is exceptional because that also provides transparency as well as to other members, such as the benefit participants that rely on this information. So again, the team continues to perform at a high level. They are routinely updating and reviewing their policies and procedures through either the board or through the annual committee process. It's an exceptionally well-run organization. As a result, we did not have any internal control deficiencies or areas or findings that we would present to you at this time. I'll turn it over for questions.
Thank you, Dan. Are there any questions from committee members, staff, or board members? Hearing none, I think this, all of the audit reports presented so far today present a very positive and encouraging picture of the status of internal controls and the functioning, the efficient functioning of operations at CMER. So I think this is something that we can certainly be proud of. So with that, Patrick, I know we were included in our packet was the 2026 audit plan, but it's not an agenda item, so is that just informational?
Yes, that is not on the agenda for approval. That's just informational only.
Okay, great. And item one, is this an approval item or is this...
It's not marked for approval. I believe the board just needs to accept, or the committee just needs to accept the reports. There's no need for formal approval.
Okay.
The 2026 audit plan is in the first slide package. If you don't mind, we can go back to that and just take a look at that. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to address. Terry, if you
have any questions on the audit plan?
Yeah. So, as I mentioned earlier, we have one more audit report we'll be providing to you in the Q3 of 2026. That's the finance and accounting audit. The 2026 plan is based upon a rotation plan that we collaboratively worked on with the CMERS team. Here is a quick summary of that and the functions that will be processes that we'll examine in 2026. And basically with the estimated dollars and estimated dollars, the budget number is at this time. Obviously, we try to look for efficiencies during the course of the audit to save you a couple dollars here and there. So are there any questions?
Questions on the audit plan? Hearing none, thank you to the CLA team for their work on this audit, and thank you for the CMERS team for their excellent work that was demonstrated by the glowing audit reports. Moving on to item number two, approval of A&O committee internal audit charter. Is this Patrick speaking on this?
Yeah, I'll handle this one, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
So thank you, everyone. I know I've spoken a little bit already today, but I apologize for not being there in person. As everyone knows, the date of the committee meeting shifted, unfortunately, I'm still at the NCBRS conference. Otherwise, I would have happily been there tomorrow. So I appreciate everybody willing to be flexible on their schedules as we moved the meeting to accommodate an FNP change in schedule. So thank you, everyone. The A&O, or I'm sorry, the internal audit charter is a routine item. It establishes the objectives and responsibilities relative to the internal audit. The charter is permanently in force, so this is more of a renewal than a new approval. But by its terms, it must be reviewed annually and updated on an as-required basis. There aren't really any substantive changes from the last time the internal audit charter was approved. So this is just a routine governance matter, making sure that the committee reviews the charter and makes a recommendation to the board for approval. So if anyone has any questions on anything in the charter, I'd be happy to discuss it. Otherwise, we are looking for a motion to recommend approval to the board.
Thank you, Patrick. Any questions from committee members?
This is Jerry. I'll move that adoption of the charter for this year.
Thank you, Jerry.
Helen, a second.
Thank you, Tim. Any objections? The item is approved. Moving on to item three, review of results for RFP for internal audit services and approval of vendor selection. This item is noticed for closed session. I believe we will need a motion to go into closed session. Is that the appropriate first step?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have two items that are marked for closed session, this item and the next item. Before we go into closed session, I'd just like to give a few brief introductory remarks, and then I'll turn it over to you to read the closed session guidance, if that's okay.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, so just taking them in order, item three relates to an RFP for internal audit services. Obviously, ERS engages the services of or internal audit services, and our contract with the existing auditor, which is CLA, ends at the end of this year. In accordance with industry best practices, we put an RFP out and received a number of responses. We need to go into closed session to discuss those competitive bids that we received. Related to item, the next item, which is also marked for closed session, that relates to a security hardening project for the ERS office spaces. This is an issue that has come before, or has been briefly discussed by the board before. We've received two separate work proposals for that project, and we need to go into closed session to discuss those competitive bids.
Thank you, Patrick. I will read the closed session language, and then I will entertain a motion to go into closed session. Please be advised that the Administration and Operations Committee may vote to convene in closed session on the following items, 3 and 4, as provided in Section 1985-1E, Wisconsin statutes, for deliberating or negotiating the purchase of public properties, the investing of public funds, or conducting other specified public business whenever competitive or bargaining reasons require a closed session. The committee may then vote to reconvene in open session following the closed session. Do I have a motion to go into closed session?
Dick Clean will make the motion.
Thank you, Justin.
Stelling second.
Thank you, Tim.
And roll call, Mr.
I believe we need a
roll call. Yes.
Thank you, Jim.
Mr. Allen?
Aye.
Mr. DeClean?
Aye.
Mr. Helling?
Aye.
Mr. Christensen?
Aye.
Quorum, and please say the time and I'll pause the recorder.
Time is 9:52.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Jan. The time is 10:23.
Thanks.
Terry, are we good to go?
Good to go.
Great. Okay, returning to open session on item number 3, review results of RFP for internal audit services and approval of vendor selection. Do I have a motion to approve the vendor that was discussed in closed session?
I'll need a motion.
Thank you, Tim.
And I'll
motion. Okay, second.
Okay.
Thank you, Jerry.
Yep.
Any objections? Hearing none, this item is approved. Moving on to item 4, approval of front desk security hardening project proposal. Do I have a motion again to approve the vendor that was discussed in closed session?
Dick Clean will make the motion.
Thank you, Justin, and I will second. Any objections? Hearing none, the item is approved. Moving on to item number 5, remote office lease discussion. Who's going to be leading the discussion on this item?
That's me again, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Patrick, go ahead.
Thank you. This item was placed on the agenda in response to an inquiry from a trustee, and I'm gratified that Trustee John Barmore is here as we discuss this item, since it was his inquiry. In essence, the ERS maintains a remote office space as a cornerstone of its business continuity and disaster recovery plans. And, you know, Mr. Barmore had a question of whether our current plan and expense was suitable for these needs. And I think it's a great question, a welcome question. I think it's always a matter of good governance to review what we're doing and make sure that our plans and costs align with what our strategic needs are. And so we put this item on the agenda to just have a kind of, to give a historical background of the remote office, its costs and purposes, and just to allow the committee and ultimately the board to have some input about whether or not it's suitable. So jumping right in, I think I'll just begin by giving running through the background and purpose and cost associated with the remote office space, and then I'd certainly be happy to take any questions from committee members or Mr. Barmore that there may be. So jumping right in, As I just indicated, the remote office space, which is located at Two Park Place on the city's northwest side, is the cornerstone of our business continuity and disaster recovery plans. Both the A&O audit charter require the system to develop a business continuity and disaster recovery plan and to ensure that the organization has a comprehensive policy on risk management. As a matter of policy, the system has elected to comply with what's called the NIST 800-53 cybersecurity standards. NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology and publishes essentially best practices and guidance for developing a variety of different policies, but particularly cybersecurity and disaster recovery planning from an IT perspective. That standard, the NIST 800-53, really drives the format of what we've selected to do with the remote office space. So NIST 800-53 directs agencies to address the potential for cyber attacks and disasters by establishing what's called an alternate processing site, which can handle essential business functions while the primary site is out of action. The standards require that the alternate processing site be geographically separated from the primary site for obvious reasons. You know, if there's some sort of natural disaster or even some type of local grid outage that is shutting down the primary site, you want your remote site to be situated a far enough distance away that it will be less likely to be affected by those things. The remote office site was selected for its location and favorable leasing costs, as I will get into in just a minute. But it's really designed to provide core mission essential capabilities in the event the primary office space goes down for some reason. These are essentially the running of merits, the processing of payroll, and being able to meet with members to continue business operations as normal. An important thing to note is that our compliance with the NIST standards is disclosed to our fiduciary liability insurance carriers. So this, you know, the fact that we have such a robust plan and we maintain a remote office is something that we actively report in various audits, internal audits, and also to our liability carriers. And it is a critical component of how we get the favorable rates that we that ERS ends up getting. So that's kind of the summary of the purpose and history behind the remote site. I can jump into cost too. We have some documentation in the packet I'd like to talk about, but maybe before I move on to that, does anyone have any questions about anything I covered? I think I would also, you know, obviously Jerry was instrumental in putting this policy into place and maintaining the remote office. So if he has anything to add outside of everything I've mentioned, I'd certainly welcome his input as well.
Well, Patrick, I think you covered it pretty well, especially I'm gratified you made the point about the cyber insurance. It is part of our application for the insurance that we have. Certain disaster recovery protocols, and I know in the discussions with our insurance broker, we've had to, from time to time, confirm with the carriers that we were, you know, continuing, you know, to comply with NIST, and also, I think we actually had to make some upgrades on one occasion in the last renewal year cycle or two, to satisfy their inquiries, I guess, is the best way to put it. Thanks again, Patrick.
Absolutely. Yeah, so, if there were ever a change to our compliance with the NIST standards, it would require disclosure to our insurance carriers. And so there would be, it's not just as simple as, you know, if we decide to pare down our disaster recovery preparedness operations that, you know, it would be a cost savings. So it would essentially be second and third order effects from that that would also impact the organization. So I think that's a, you know, an important consideration to think about when you're looking at the costs associated with maintaining a remote office.
The chair was going to make one other comment that occurred to me. The issue had arisen, if I may.
Yeah, go ahead, Jimmy.
Okay. This an issue came up. I'm not sure it's the same one that's been raised, but it came up from a member of the Finance and Personnel Committee of several years ago about, you know, why do we have to have this, and why can't we just, why do we have to have, you know, rent a space in a commercial building? And, you know, why can't we use an abandoned fire station, not abandoned, but, you know, one that's been closed, or a school property that's closed? And just as a point of information, and Jeff can expand on Terry, because Terry was present at the time this was done, we actually had to trench. We had to, you know, have, get a backhoe out there and trench into Two-Park Place to run our fiber optic cables in order to support our data services there. So it's not every building that's wired to handle our you know, data requirements. And so surplus buildings that the city or the school system had would require an awful lot of upgrade at considerable expense, and it would take us some years to recover that cost. And that's really why we didn't pursue that option at that time. That's just as a point of information.
Yeah, and not to put too, sorry, did I cut somebody off?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, not to put too fine a point on it, but the NIST standards do require that the location be specifically tailored to the organization's business needs. And so, you know, what Jerry was just talking about is exactly that. There's been customization done at this office space that makes it suitable for our use. As you know, as Jerry indicated, we're a very data heavy organization that requires a lot of IT infrastructure and connectivity, secure connectivity. And so those startup costs, for lack of a better phrase, are something that would be associated with any other remote office. And so the fact that they've already been, that this location has already been specifically tailored to our needs means that we don't need to re-expend those same costs at an alternate location. I think to give another example of why this conference is paying dividends, we did discuss briefly in one of the sessions about remote office locations and disaster recovery plans, and a large peer plan adopted the policy that Jerry just described, you know, essentially renting remote office space from the municipality that they served. Well, they were disturbed to find out that for over a year, their office space had been reassigned to another agency and was currently in use by that agency, and the city did not notify them that that was happening. So they had to scramble to find a remote office space. So relying on a, you know, even though it is our plan sponsor, relying on a third-party organization to find you office space does come with its own challenges as well. And I think that would be also an important consideration to take into account when looking at whether to go with a vacant office space or a privately leased space like we have now.
Well, one last point of memory on this. One of the aldermen also had been contacted by the Oneida tribe. It turns out that in their casino operations, they have an expertise in data security, and they actually sell this service commercially. And they had pitched us to subscribe to their service, but the location wasn't as far away as where we have it now. And also, we were a little, it was expensive, and there was an issue of independence from the political branches in connection with that. So we didn't really end up seriously pursuing that. But there are alternatives. You know, there is a commercial operation that will do this, and the Oneidas are one of them, and there are probably others as well, if that's a concern.
So if
thank
I could make that, could I make
yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
On that. I have had that in my 45-year career. That was one of the options we actually pursued. Typically what happens there is you are on a contract basis with one of those providers. We used IBM as a matter of fact. However, in the event that there's a large regional disaster, you are, it's first come, first serve. So if all of a sudden, as happened to us, part of downtown Milwaukee lost electricity, if we didn't have a dedicated facility, we would be competing with all the other people that are contracted with that provider, first come, first serve basis to actually utilize that space. So that's a risk. Not that it's going to happen, but that's disaster recovery is risk mitigation, period, stop. So that's the entire premise around it. In our case, we have gone and actually dedicated facilities and dedicated funding and dedicated resources to make sure that we can instantaneously walk over there right now if we needed to. So there's benefit to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Any discussion or questions from other committee members? Yes, go ahead, Tim.
Kind of a worst case scenario question. Do we have to disclose that area? I know it's kind of too late already. Everybody knows where that second site is. But I'm just thinking worst case scenario, if someone is specifically targeting Seamers and they get to downtown, they'd easily know where that second location is. Is that...
All the lease agreements are a matter of public record, so okay. Yeah, I mean, we're not disclosing anything in this meeting that isn't already publicly available information. So, you know, unfortunately, we're not a private corporation where, you know, we can disclose only what we want. We're bound by, you know, the state of Wisconsin's open records and open meetings laws. And so, you know, we obviously did not make the disaster recovery and business continuity plans part of the public record, since those are confidential documents that we do not release to the public. But the location of the secondary office is a matter of public record.
Okay, thanks.
Chair?
Yes, go ahead, John.
Yeah, Patrick, thank you for all the research and your comprehensive answer. And I just want to reiterate that I absolutely support disaster recovery. We stood them up and signed these contracts when I was on the board previously. And as you did mention, it was more of a question of reviewing the right sizing and just going over that, because based on the various standards, if, for example, you have to check 10 boxes, well, now with remote and home office, if 6 of those boxes are necessary at the remote office, but 4 of them can be addressed more virtually hybrid. Do we need all the square footage out at Park Place was kind of the gist of the review.
Yeah, it's a great, and like I said, I think that this is a good governance exercise. So I'm glad you asked the question. It was a good opportunity for me certainly to get into the history of how all this developed and become more familiar with the the federal standards that we're following. So I welcome the opportunity to take a look at this. So I appreciate you bringing it up. Part of developing the business continuity and disaster recovery plans is identifying what is and is not a core function. And so the size of the remote office space was tailored to reflect those essential business operations that we think would be necessary if we truly needed to shift our entire operation to a remote site. We recognize that, you know, not all of the staff, but approximately a third of the staff, maybe a little bit less, would be required to be in person. Those plans do contain a remote component for the remainder of the staff. So that sort of efficiency of only having who you need in the office, it's already baked into these plans, and the size of the remote office location was specifically tailored to accommodate those core functions as determined in those policies.
Thank you, Patrick. And to clarify, is the decision before us, or is there a decision before us to select one of the options, or is this item appears to be just listed for discussion?
This is just a discussion item, Mr. Chair. It was just, again, an opportunity to provide this background information for the benefit of the committee and ultimately the board. And like I said, I think it's a good governance exercise to revisit these types of issues to make sure that, you know, the policies that we've chosen are still aligned with our strategy. And I think in this case, our business continuity plan and disaster recovery plans are well suited to our current business needs. I think they take advantage of the remote capabilities that are available. And I think the plan was very judicious in identifying this office location. As you can see, I haven't quite gotten into it, but I'll just mention it briefly. The leasing cost here is extremely favorable. If you look at the market rates on the northwest side for Class A properties, which is what this is, even at the end of this lease, you know, we get a little bit of a lease increase each year. We are still drastically below what the average rent is for this type of office space. So I commend Jerry and everyone at ERS and the board at the time who negotiated this lease agreement, because it really is, I think, very, very favorable from a cost effectiveness standpoint.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. Any further discussion on this item? Okay, hearing none. Thank you. Moving on to item number 6, IT projects portfolio. Will this be Jeff or are you, Patrick?
Jeff will be taking this item, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Jeff, take it away.
Absolutely appreciate the opportunity. So you guys will be very familiar with the slides we're going to put up, because you see them every month, just a couple of words and names have changed. See, this is the standard IT projects and ticket statistics that we produce every month. See if there's... The network redesign is actually completed. So we are in the process now. We actually had a CLA team come in and assess the work that we did. And the good news was we made no change in our security posture, which was one of the things you can obviously do when you introduce new hardware. And so we did get a list of things they would like us to do to help us take advantage of the new hardware, which we plan to put in place before the next real audit that happens in the October-November timeframe. So that's kind of our bogey on that. The other items on here, we have upgraded all of our desktops. Some of those were out of warranty and need to be replaced. That's all been completed. And everything else there is pretty much the normal stuff that we've been working on for quite some time. And the ticket statistics maintained as they normally are. Any questions on this slide?
Any questions? Go ahead.
All right. Terry, you can move up to the next one. Thank you. There's the colors. I was getting worried the colors weren't on there. So this is a lot of segment information represented in a more graphical way. So we color code it to make sure that it's easy to see whether anything is behind schedule or not. And once again, nothing is behind schedule for us. Network redesign is the 98%. I think when we actually produced this slide for the month that was actually reported in the project management office, we were still waiting on the CLA report, which we have report gotten that now, and we are going to get ready just to close that up and sign off on that closure document. The first one on there is an important one. Microsoft, in its infinite wisdom, has decided to deprecate Windows Server 2016. So we're in the process of upgrading ourselves to Windows Server 2025, which is the most mainstream supported version of Windows Server right now. And we're in the process of making all that happen. Similarly, SQL Server is Microsoft SQL Server product is also going to be deprecated. So we are moving up to a more current version of that as well. For exactly the same reason. I think Microsoft can't make any more money on it, so therefore they decided they're going to deprecate it. And then the next little bit on the bottom is just historical data for how many hours we actually expended on some of the projects that are either fit or that are finished. So any questions on that slide? All right, well, hearing none, any other questions for IT in general? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. I know in general, I had asked for kind of an update on the ERS sort of integration with the city's ongoing Workday project. Is that something that we're prepared to discuss as part of the IT project portfolio, or is that something we can address at a later meeting?
No, Mr. Chair, we are prepared to discuss that today, and we have Terry Siddiqui here to give you an update on that issue.
Okay, great, thank you. Go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, so we've been working with the Workday team, specifically the payroll group, on that file that we receive every 2 weeks. We actually received two files, one for the ERS data, one for the WRS data, because we're the agent for the WRS file. It's been progressing. There have been hiccups along the way. The latest iteration, which actually I just received the file this morning, I've been promised will be a bigger improvement than I've seen before. But so far, our issues have been related to, or have been whittled down to, frankly, a couple of file formatting issues, a little bit of data content, which is actually a bigger issue for me, and then some stuff related to adjustments and how those things are coming through. I won't get too far into the weeds with those. Progress has been a little bit slower, but it has picked up actually in the recent past. So we're getting closer. We're working together with the team to get those working and get our files on a regular basis. And frankly, we were actually developing some contingent plans as well, if need be, if something bad were to happen or if there were issues later on. But on that portfolio slide that you saw before, I think I marked it at about 50% complete, given the past year or so of providing the design information, testing, and now validating the final output. So that's the current state, I guess, unless there are more specific questions you have.
Thank you, Tara. Any questions from committee members on this? One question that I have, Terry, is are there any upcoming, I guess, milestones or key kind of checkpoints that, certain things should be completed by in order to stay on the current project schedule that where it might be possible for you to maybe provide an update, whether it's via email or otherwise? Just so we can be kept aware if things are trending in a positive direction and a negative direction. Anything that you're aware of is kind of on the horizon like that?
The only thing that I'm aware of is actually the test file I just received this morning. So that's really the main one, because based on those results, I will know exactly how far and how well the payroll parallel went in one of the test environments. And if I can match that data up properly with what we have today, then that gets me a lot more comfort that we're doing well. Now, as far as milestones are concerned, that really is driven by the Workday team. My milestones internally are simply, I work backwards from what the go-live date is, and then what they, or the Workday team has said the parallel dates are. And I kind of expect at this point that when we do the next parallel, which is, I believe, well, they're working on it right now, but I think it's next month, I think they're hitting one more, that I will have a file that I will be able to complete to production 100% and say, and have very few differences. Or explainable differences. And so my goal really is today's file, and then next month, I hope it's a clean one.
Gary, for the benefit of the committee, can you explain your process, what you mean by a parallel file, and kind of help them understand how we're validating this data, and what our goal is while we're working with Workday and the two files?
Sure. So the way parallel means that whatever data set was produced from PeopleSoft, I want this file from Workday to produce the same result set. And if it is different, then I need to have an explanation as to why certain records were different or whatever they did with the data. Now, the pay period that's being used for validating this is pay period 19 of 2025. All I've done at this point, all I'll be doing right now is saying, okay, get me a file. I'm going to load it up into Merits in an old test environment and say, am I getting the same test answers that production file gave me? Paper 19 did not have any major like retros or anything of that nature, like contract settlement stuff. So in the future, I think they are planning to have another payroll with a pay period that had contract supplements, so we can work through those as well. That, I frankly, is the biggest thing left over at is the contract supplement stuff. But that's really what a parallel is. I got results from system A, I'm getting results from system B, match the two of them up. 100% match is perfect, but I'm sure there'll be differences. Why are those differences there? And are those differences acceptable, or do we need to make changes either on the Merits side or in Workday, which is more likely?
Great. Thank you, Terry, for the insight. And if anything, I guess, materially changes that's worth notifying us, please feel free to reach out.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. If there are no other questions on item 6, we'll move on to item 7, organizational and personnel update. Patrick, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few updates on the slide listed. We are going to be conducting oral board examinations for the benefit services specialist position on June 23rd and 25th. So hopefully that vacancy will be filled very shortly. For the chief financial officer position, we are in the process of drafting the job announcement bulletin with the intention of posting it for internal promotion. Moving on to the last two there, office assistant 3 and records technician 2. We've gotten a little clever with these. This is the office assistant 3 is Gloria. She is our main receptionist at the front desk, and then the records technician 2 obviously works in the records room, scanning room, but also provides backup to the front desk area. So we are trying to fill those positions quickly in order to avoid a staffing gap up front. We've had a lot of people stepping in whenever there's been a vacancy up front. And so these, you know, we're particularly concerned with getting these positions filled relatively quickly. So in order to accomplish that, we are piggybacking on an existing eligible list that was created for the Board of Zoning Appeals for the Office Assistant 3 position, and we're hoping to make at least one and possibly both appointments from that list. But whether or not we get two suitable candidates remains to be seen, but I'm optimistic that we'll get at least one. So the bottom line there is that we're working to fill those positions as quickly as possible. I do have one, unfortunate update to this slide is that we received on Monday the 2 weeks notice from Keith Dickerson, our investment analyst, one of our two investment analyst seniors. He was offered another position with a private firm and has elected to take it. And this is unfortunately one of those situations where while we're happy for Keith, it's a great opportunity. For him, it will be a loss for the organization, and we are certainly going to miss Keith on the investment team. I know David and Eric are working very closely with Katrina, our human resources administrator, to get a posting out as quickly as possible to fill that vacancy. We'll certainly have more updates for the board as they come in. So Once again, happy for Keith. It's a good opportunity, but we're very sorry to be seeing him go. He's been a tremendous asset to ERS.
Okay. Thank you, Patrick. Are there any questions or comments from committee members? Okay, hearing none, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll end a motion.
Thank you, Tim. And I will second. Great, thank you very much.
Take care, everyone.
Have a good day, everyone.